tier to sustain the defenders. Passing the stacks of food, they came to the dormitory for the men. Rows of bunks, tables and benches for those off duty, washing facilities, and several privies, built on the side of the tower to protrude over the drop. She wrinkled her nose. Not the most savoury of solutions to the men's needs, but an effective one, nevertheless. Food and weapons were well supplied, she realised, but there was a more important need. Water. "Let's check the water," she said, and headed for the steps leading to the 9th floor. Here, there was another central staircase between the 8th and 9th levels. This staircase was wood, more like a wide, steep ladder, and could be withdrawn in the event that attackers broke through to the lower floor. They climbed to the 9th level. This was the commander's floor, the administrative level. Half a dozen sleeping chambers were set along the curve of the wall. There were racks of weapons along one wall, and in the middle of the floor was a large open space that served as the command centre. A table with a dozen seats dominated the space. This could be used for councils of war, or for eating and recreation, as the need arose. To one side was a kitchen area, well ventilated, so that smoke from the large oven and open grill areas could escape. Cassandra had studied the layout of the South Tower, and had visited it several times over the years, ensuring that supplies were constantly replenished, and any items that were out of date or spoiled were removed. She gestured to a wooden ladder on the right-hand side. "Water's up there," she said, and she led the way, climbing the steep ladder and shoving aside the trapdoor at the top. The tower was surmounted by a pointed spire, covered in tiles. Inside the conical space were two large stone cisterns. There were steps at the side of these. She climbed one low flight of steps and eased open a lid in the wooden panel that covered the cistern. She peered in. Water lapped a few centimetres below the top. She cupped a handful and tasted it. It was fresh and sweet. The other cistern was the same, nearly full with good clean water. The cisterns were fed by rainwater from the roof. They were drained regularly and allowed to refill to ensure the water didn't stagnate. It usually rained regularly in this part of the country, so continuity of supply wasn't a problem. She climbed down and led the way down the ladder to the 9th level once more. A soldier waited there to meet them, obviously wanting to talk to her. She raised an eyebrow. "What is it?" she asked. "The king, my lady," he replied. And she recognised him as one of the men she had detailed to bring her father to the tower. He pointed toward one of the chambers set along the wall. "We put him in that chamber, my lady. It's got a good bed, and it's nice and airy for him. He's quite comfortable." "Thank you," she said, starting towards the door he'd indicated. "I'll have a few words with him now." Then she saw the doubtful look on the man's face and stopped. "Is there a problem?" He shook his head. "No, no, my lady. He's fine. Just, he's sleeping at the moment, and maybe we shouldn't wake him." She touched his arm gratefully. It was interesting to see the devotion and love that her father inspired in the men serving under him. Unlike Diamond, she thought bitterly. "Thank you," she said. "Keep an eye on him, and let me know when he wakes." He knuckled his forehead in salute. "I'll do that, my lady." He stepped back and took up a position outside the chamber door. Cassandra turned back to the sergeant. "By the way," she said, "what's your name? I can hardly go on calling you sergeant, can I?" The sergeant grinned at her. "Don't matter to me, my lady, but my man christened me Merlin, so that's what I usually answer to." "Merlin it is then," she said. She sat down in one of the heavy wooden chairs around the command table, and gestured for him to sit as well. He did so, a little awkward at relaxing so close to the Princess Regent. "Well, Merlin, we're in good shape here. Plenty of food and water and weapons. We should be able to hold out indefinitely. Certainly until my husband and the Ranger Commandant get back." "Yes, my lady. When do you think that'll be?" he asked. She hesitated a second or two. It wouldn't be good for morale if the men knew she had no idea what was delaying Horace. "Shouldn't be much more than a week, I'd think," she said, forcing a confident tone into her voice. She didn't want to raise any immediate expectations, and now that Merlin knew their position was secure, the prospect of a 1 week wait wouldn't be too daunting. She was saved from further discussion of Horace's whereabouts when one of the archers mounted the stairs, obviously looking for her. "Over here," she said, as he glanced curiously around the open space of the 9th floor. He turned and walked toward them. "It's Captain Diamond, my lady," he said. "He's at the gap in the stairs, and he's requested a parley." 38. "Better come with me, Merlin," she said. "You should hear what he has to say." Together, they retraced their steps down the ladder to the 8th floor, then hurried out the heavy door to the spiral staircase. The archer who had apprised her of Diamond's request for a parley followed them, and now she recognized him as the man she had left at the gap in the stairs, with orders to shoot anyone who appeared round the bend in the staircase. She smiled grimly. Presumably, Diamond had called out before he showed himself, making sure he wouldn't be an immediate target. They reached the gap. There was nobody visible at the lower end. She glanced interrogatively at the 2 foot soldiers who had remained on watch. "Where is he?" she asked. One of them jerked a thumb downward. "He's there, my lady. Just round the curve." He grinned. "Don't think he trusted us." She smiled in return. "He's no fool," she said. Then she raised her voice and called down the stairway, her voice echoing off the stone walls and ceiling. "Diamond, are you there?" There was a pause, and then she recognized his voice. He sounded quite close, and she realized he must be just around the elbow in the stairway. "Cassandra, I have a flag of truce here." As she heard the words, a pole appeared round the stonework. A white cloth hung limply from it. The bearer waved it a few times, presumably to help those above see it. "So I see," she replied. There was another pause, and then Diamond spoke again, uncertainty in his voice. "You'll honour it?" She was insulted by the implication that she might violate a flag of truce. But then she realized it was the sort of thing Diamond would do. And if he would do it, he'd assume that others would as well. "Yes," she said, the irritation obvious in her voice. "You're safe. We won't shoot. Although, God knows, why not?" "I need your word," he said. Now the irritation in her voice was even more apparent. "You've got it. Stop skulking and come out in the open." Slowly, Diamond emerged from behind the curve in the stairway, the white flag held in his right hand. He moved out into the center of the stairs and peered upward. He shaded his eyes with his left hand. It was dim in the stairwell, and neither of them was carrying a torch. "I can't see you too well," he said. "I can see you perfectly," she said. "Get on with what you have to say." "I'm offering you an accommodation," he said. "Surrender and I'll spare your life, and Madeline's as well." She felt a surge of relief as he said the last words. She'd been half expecting that this parley would be about Madeline, that Diamond would tell her he'd captured her daughter and would use her to force Cassandra's surrender. Now it was obvious that he believed Maddie was in the tower with her, so she was safe, for the moment at least. "You'll simply let us go, will you?" she asked, the disbelief all too clear in her voice. "I didn't say that. You'd be kept prisoner until I could send you out of the country. I'd want your sworn oath that you wouldn't try to come back and take my throne from me." "My father's throne, I think you mean," she said. And when he didn't reply, she continued. "Why this sudden generosity, Diamond?"
"I'll have gotten what I wanted. My followers want a return to the male line of succession. Once I'm on the throne, that will have been restored. They believe having a female succeed to the throne is against reason and tradition and God's law."
"I wondered when he'd be brought into it," she said sarcastically.
"I'm offering you your life. I'll see you're well provided for. You and Madeline could live quite well in Gallica or Toscana. Not Scandia, however," he added. "Arik and his Scandians might not take too kindly to having you tossed off the throne."
"Aren't you forgetting something?" she asked. "It's a wonderful plan, but I don't think my husband will stand for it once he's back from the north. Nor Gillen. I doubt you'll stay on the throne too long once they hear I've been banished." He looked down, hesitating for a moment. Then he said regretfully,
"I'm sorry to tell you, Cassandra, but Horus is dead. And Gillen."
An icy cold hand clutched at her heart as he spoke. She couldn't conceive of a world without Horus. Big, powerful, cheerful Horus. He was a tower of strength for her. He was kind and gentle and caring. And he had never been defeated in battle. He couldn't be gone. And Gillen, too, with his ready smile and friendly disposition. How could they both have been killed? "I don't believe it," she said. Diamond shook his head again.
"I'm sorry to tell you. I truly am. I really liked Horus. But that small band of rebels he went to shoo away was actually an army of 150 men. They fought a pitched battle 2 days ago, and both Horus and Gillen were killed, along with most of their men."
He let her think about that. Then he continued.
"So don't cling to any false hopes that they'll be back to rescue you, Cassandra. They won't. And my offer is the best one you'll get."
She paused, knowing that if she spoke immediately, the doubt in her voice would give away her uncertainty. She needed to sound strong, she realized.
"I'll need time to consider it," she said eventually.
He came back at her immediately, sensing the strength of his position.
"Don't take too long. As I said, my offer is the best one you'll get. But it's only on the table for a day. After that, we'll drive you out of this tower."
"You can try," she said. She was on firmer ground now, and her voice was more confident. "But we've got food and weapons and water. We can hold out here for months. You could die of old age trying to take this tower."
"We could burn you out," he threatened.
She laughed. This time, her reaction was genuine. "You don't know a lot about the construction of this tower, do you?" she asked. "It's mostly stone. There's no wooden framework, and stone won't burn."
"The floors are timber," he pointed out. "They'll burn well enough."
She sensed the sergeant glancing at her. She met his anxious gaze and shook her head to reassure him. "As I said, you don't know too much about the design of this tower. We've got two huge water cisterns in the roof, and one of them has pipes running down to the lower levels. The floors are hardwood, so they won't burn easily, and if you try to set them alight, we can simply drench them with water." There was a long pause. Then Diamond replied, but without his former confidence.
"And then you'll have used up your drinking water," he said.
"Rain, Diamond," she said. "The cisterns are filled by rainwater collected on the roof. And, as you know, it rains quite often in this part of the country. 2 or 3 nights of good rain will refill the cistern." Diamond looked up at her. Anger was beginning to show on his face. He knew that the South Tower was virtually impregnable. A small force could hold it indefinitely, and he didn't have time to spend on a lengthy siege. Horace and Gillen were very much alive, even if they were contained in the old hill fort by the Weasel River, and he knew that situation wouldn't last for too much longer. His forces there were becoming restive. Messengers had told him that they'd lost a lot of men. They'd been driven back with heavy losses each time they attacked Horace's small force. Sooner or later, they would start to drift away. Mercenaries fought for profit, after all, and there was little of that to be found besieging a capable enemy in a well-defended position. He had hoped to bluff Cassandra, to make her panic and surrender, with the news that Horace was dead. Of course he had no intention of honouring his promise to banish her. Once she and Maddie were in his hands, he would have them killed. He faced her one more time, trying to sound more confident than he felt.
"I'll give you a day to consider my offer," he said. "One day only. After that, if you insist on defying me, you will suffer the consequences."
"I'll give you my answer this time tomorrow," she told him. He couldn't resist one more sally.
"If you're as smart as you claim to be, you'll accept," he said.
Then he stepped quickly into the shelter of the curving wall, and she heard his footsteps receding down the stairs. She looked at Merlin and raised her eyebrows, puffing out her cheeks and releasing a long breath. She felt exhausted. "Well, at least we know one thing. He doesn't have Maddie," she said. Merlin scratched his beard thoughtfully.
"That's true."
He hesitated, not sure whether he should ask the next question, then decided to do so anyway.
"Do you believe him, my lady?" he asked. "About Sir Horace. Do you believe he's dead?"
She shook her head. "I just don't know, Merlin. It would explain why we've heard nothing from the north. But..." She hesitated.
"But what, my lady?"
"But Horace is not an easy man to kill. A lot of people have tried in the past, and it didn't work out too well for them."
"So you think he's alive?"
"Yes, I do," she said. "I think I'd feel it if he were dead." But as she said it, she wished she could be certain. 39. There was a balcony running round the tower at the 9th floor, affording a panoramic view of the land below the castle. Cassandra was pacing it now, looking out at the parklands below and the forest in the distance, while she pondered her situation. Several hours had passed since her conversation with Diamond. Immediately below her, she had a view of the castle courtyard. She could see men there, moving from the keep to the gatehouse and occasionally to the stables. On the battlements, she could see sentries standing watch. It all appeared normal, except that the sentries and the men in the courtyard were not part of the castle garrison. They were Diamond's men. And now they were protected from outside attack by Castle Araluin's massive fortifications. Even if Horace and Gillen did appear with their men, they would have no chance of breaking in. She leaned on the rough stone of the balcony wall and sighed bitterly.
She was in a total impasse. She and her men were safe for the moment, and for the foreseeable future. But they had no way of breaking out, of driving the invaders out of the castle. They were outnumbered, and they continued to survive only by virtue of the well-planned defences of the South Tower. Where was Maddie? The question kept hammering at her. Ingrid had thought she might be outside the castle. But where? And what was she doing? Cassandra racked her brains, trying to think of a way of contacting her. If Maddie was outside the castle, and if Cassandra could get a message to her, she could head north and alert Horace to the current situation. Maddie's ranger horse, Bumper, was outside the walls, Cassandra knew, at the small farm where Gillen had arranged for him to be stabled. If Maddie could get to him, she could be at the Weasel River within 3 days. If, she thought. But even if Maddie could reach the Weasel, then what? Horace might be dead. At best, if anything Diamond had said was the truth, he was trapped in a hill fort, surrounded by a superior force. How would he break out of that trap? And if he did, he would still face the problem of breaking into Castle Araluin. But at least he'd be here, close to hand. And the thought of his presence was a comforting one. Besides, once he was back, he could raise the army from the surrounding countryside. In times of war, the relatively small garrison of the castle was augmented by drafts of men-at-arms from the farms and villages of the fief. Mobilizing them would take some time, perhaps a week or two, but he would then have a sizable force for Diamond to reckon with. The same inevitable predicament raised its head. No matter how many men he had, how could he hope to break into the castle? No attacker had managed that in living memory. Even more Gareth, when he rebelled against her father, had bypassed the castle. She laughed bitterly. It was an ironic situation. She and her men were trapped here in the tower, but relatively safe from attack by Diamond's men. They, in turn, would be trapped in the castle, but relatively safe from attack by Horace's forces. And on top of that, there was still the fundamental problem facing her. Where was Maddie? The scenario she had just envisaged hinged on Cassandra's being able to make contact with her, and Cassandra simply couldn't see how that could be done. She heard footsteps on the balcony behind her, and turned to see one of the archers hurrying round the curve of the tower toward her, saluting as he came. "My lady, Sergeant Merlin says you should come immediately," he said, his tone urgent. She began to make her way to the door leading back into the tower. "What's happening?" she said. She was puzzled. Diamond had given her a day to consider his offer. She assumed that meant he would try nothing further until that deadline had expired. There was the implication of a truce in his offer. But she realized, not for the first time, that Diamond could not be trusted. "Merlin's not sure, my lady, but there's something going on down the stairway. We can hear them moving. There's a lot of whispering going on, and it sounds like they're dragging something heavy up to the gap." She ran down the ladder to the lower floor and headed for the stairs. Merlin and 4 other men, all of them archers, were standing just above the gap in the stairway, sheltering behind the bend in the stairs. The sergeant looked around as she approached, holding his finger to his lips. "What's happening, Merlin?" she asked in a whisper. He pointed down the stairs to the edge of the gap. "Listen, my lady," he told her. She moved out from the shelter of the wall and craned her head to listen. The sound of low-pitched voices floated up the stairway to her, echoing off the curving stone walls. She couldn't make out what they were saying, but there was a definite sense of urgency about them.
Occasionally, a voice would be raised, resulting in urgent hisses for silence. She stepped back into cover, peering round the rough stone to look down the stairwell.
"Something's going on, my lady. They're planning something," Merlin said, his voice close to her ear.
She nodded, frowning. That much was obvious. But what exactly did they have in mind? She held up a hand to forestall any further comment from the sergeant. There was another noise apparent now. It sounded like something heavy and wooden being dragged up the stone stairs. She could hear slow, deliberate footsteps on the stairs now, and the occasional grunt of effort from the men below. She turned to her archers.
"Get ready."
They nodded. They all had arrows knocked. She stepped out again for a clearer look, ignoring Merlin's warning murmur. The stairs below were empty. She could see the gap, with the yawning dark drop below it. Then the first three or four stairs below that. Then nothing. But the dragging sound continued, getting louder with each minute. Then it stopped, and she heard more whispering. She caught the eye of one of the archers and gestured to the door that opened into the eighth floor.
"Get more men," she said, "and bring half a dozen pikes."
The man saluted and ran to do her bidding, and she turned her attention to the stairway again. The dragging, scraping noise had started again, much closer this time. Then she saw what was causing it. A rectangular wooden barrier, like a movable wall, appeared in the stairway below the gap, being shoved forward by men behind it. It was made of boards nailed to a timber framework, and it filled the space between the walls of the staircase. The men pushing and lifting it moved it at an angle so that it could advance up the stairs. It stood about a meter and a half high, and there was an open space 20 centimeters high at the base. The men behind it were mostly hidden from sight, although from time to time a head would appear above the top of the barrier for a second or two. Cassandra addressed the three remaining archers. "The minute you see someone, shoot him," she said. They all nodded. A head appeared above the barrier, as its owner looked up to see what was happening above them. Instantly, an archer drew, aimed, and released. But the head had disappeared again, and the arrow whizzed through empty space, then ricocheted off the stone wall below with a screech of metal on stone. She heard a curse from the man who had come so close to death. She frowned. The wall would protect Diamond's men from the arrows and spears of her troops, but it wouldn't bridge the gap in the stairs. It was too short for that. She looked more closely, straining her eyes, and made out a pair of hinges in the barrier. Then she could see that there was a gate in the centre, perhaps a metre wide. Obviously, once the barrier was in position, those behind it could open the gate. And what? The barrier stopped a metre from the edge of the gap. On the right-hand side, one of the men pushing and shoving had grown careless. The top of his helmeted head was visible above the roughly constructed shield. The helmet made a poor target for her archer's arrows. They would skid off harmlessly. But her sling was a different matter. She loaded a shot into the pouch and began whirling the sling around her head. Stepping out in the open, she released. There was a resounding clang as the lead shot hit the helmet and the man went down, staggering back and falling down the stairs with a mighty clatter. She heard a voice shouting urgently, "Stay down, for pity's sake! She's got a sling!" Nobody else showed themselves above the barrier. Then they heard more scraping and slithering, and a timber bridge, about a metre wide, began to slide forward from under the barrier, reaching out across the gap in the stairway. "Push it back," she ordered, and her men moved forward, pikes in hand, to obey. But they were too late. The makeshift bridge reached the upper side of the gap and fell into place. She could see that there was a transverse beam nailed to the lower end. It was set against the edge of the stairs and held the bridge in position, no matter how hard they tried to push it back. Merlin touched her arm. "Smoke, my lady," he said. "I smell smoke." She sniffed the air. He was right. There was an oily smell of smoke drifting up from the lower stairs. She frowned. The steps were stone. They wouldn't burn. So what was... In answer, an object appeared, hurled over the top of the barrier, trailing a thin line of smoke and sailing across the gap to shatter on the steps above where she stood. Then another, and another. They were round clay pots, she realized, and each one held a mixture of oil and pitch and a lighted wick. As they shattered against the stone, the flame from their wicks ignited the flammable mixture inside, and a cloud of noxious, dark smoke began to fill the stairway. Her men began coughing, and she felt her own eyes tearing up. "They'll try to cross in the smoke," she warned. "Be ready." She turned to Merlin, standing by her with one of the ineffectual pikes. Ineffectual against the replacement bridge, perhaps, but not against the men who might try to cross it. "Get the door open," she ordered. "We have to let the smoke out." Dimly, through her streaming, itching eyes, she saw the central gate and the barrier begin to open outward, the gap between the edges growing larger. She loaded another shot and began whirling the sling. Through a veil of tears, she saw a figure step into the gap and out onto the bridge. His upper body was covered by a shield, and he held a spear in his right hand. 40. Cassandra changed her aim point as the attacker advanced across the bridge. She whirled the sling one more time as he moved tentatively above the yawning gap, then released. The shot slammed into his left knee with a sickening crack, smashing bone and tendons. The knee gave way beneath him, and he slumped to one side, releasing his grip on the spear as he hung over the edge of the 7-story drop, scrabbling frantically at the rough wood to recover, and failing. With a horrible scream, he fell into the gap beside the makeshift bridge, plummeting down into the darkness, screaming all the way until they could hear a distant, ugly thump. The scream was cut off. The door in the barrier slammed shut once more. The next man in line had seen his comrade's fate and wasn't prepared to risk the crossing. Cassandra heard a raised voice shouting orders. "Diamond," she realized. "More smoke pots. Get more of the pots up here. If they can't see us, they can't shoot us." The smoke was clearing in the upper part of the stairway now, although the defender's eyes still smarted and ran with tears. The open door had created a draft to let the dense, choking clouds out. There was a brief lull, and she heard feet running on the stairs below her. Presumably, men were fetching more of the smoke pots. Merlin pointed to the replacement bridge. "Could we maybe burn it, my lady?" She considered the idea, but shook her head. It was solid timber. "It would take too long to get it burning," she said, "and I doubt they'd leave us in peace while we did it." Some of Diamond's men had bows, she knew. They might not be as skilled as her archers, but at close quarters like this, they could hardly miss. There was a flash of flint on steel in the dimness on the other side of the barrier. "They're lighting the fuses," she said. "Everyone, get ready." She removed her scarf and wrapped it round her nose and mouth. Turning to the youngest of the troopers standing ready, She pointed up the stairs. Fetch scarves and kerchiefs for everyone, and a bucket of water to soak them. Wet scarves around their noses and mouths might help against the choking smoke, she thought. He nodded and turned, running lightly up the stairs. She heard Diamond issuing orders once more. Don't throw them so far! Try to lob them close to the end of the bridge! That would concentrate the smoke where they stood waiting, she realized, and create better cover for the men crossing the bridge. She loaded her sling again and let it dangle down beside her, swinging back and forth like a snake's head as it prepared to strike. The first of the clay pots sailed over the gap, hitting the stairway 4 steps above the bridge. Before it could ignite the oil and pitch inside, however, Merlon reached out with his pike and scooped it down the stairs, sending it tumbling into the gap. But his action came at a cost. Even as she began to congratulate him, he gave a gasp of pain and dropped the pike, clutching at his upper arm where a crossbow bolt had struck him. He sank awkwardly to the stairs. She reached out, grabbing his jerkin, and with the strength of desperation, heaved him back into cover as another bolt ricocheted off the step behind him. He screamed in pain as she dragged him in, but managed to gasp his thanks, realizing she had saved his life. Think nothing of it, she said. We need you. Another smoke pot flew over the gap. This one went too high and smashed on the stairs above them. The resultant cloud of smoke billowed up, but someone had had the intelligence to open the doorway on the floor above them, and most of the smoke was sucked upward by the draft. The young soldier had returned now with scarves and kerchiefs and a large bucket full of water. He began to distribute the wet cloths to the defenders, who wrapped them round their noses and mouths. He was just in time, as another 2 smoke pots crashed onto the steps. These were better aimed, and they hit the stonework level with Cassandra's position. She hastily dipped her scarf into the bucket and retied it. The wet cloth filtered the smoke to a certain extent, but her eyes were still smarting and weeping, and she found it hard to see. One of the pots had deposited its load of oil and pitch only a few meters from her. The young trooper seized the bucket, still half full, and dumped the water onto the burning pitch, smothering the flames. Good thinking, she croaked. Then she gestured upward to the doorway. Get more water! Get a bucket chain going! He nodded, his own eyes red and weeping, and darted away to do her bidding. The flames close by her had only been temporarily doused, more by the sheer impact of the water cutting off the air to them than by the extinguishing properties of the water itself. They flickered to life once more, feeding off the pitch, and began to generate more smoke. Through streaming, reddened eyes, she saw the gate and the barrier opening again, and another enemy soldier advanced through it. At least, she thought, the bridge was so narrow it would permit only one man at a time to cross. But if any of them gained a foothold on this side of the gap, she and her men would be in trouble. She whirled her sling and launched a shot at the man. But he was crouched low behind his shield and didn't offer her a convenient target. The shot hit his shield with a vicious thud. He was stopped by the impact for a second. Then he continued to advance. 2 more smoke pots soared across the gap, shattering and adding their billowing fumes to the hellish scene in the stairwell. 3 arrows slammed into the man's shield, and he stopped uncertainly. The narrow bridge didn't provide the most stable footing, and crossing it in the current conditions, while being targeted by archers and with visibility uncertain, required enormous concentration.
Step aside, my lady,
said a hoarse voice behind her. She turned and saw one of her men, a tall, broad-shouldered corporal, standing ready with a heavy spear. His eyes were fixed on the enemy soldier, now two-thirds of the way across the bridge, advancing slowly. Cassandra moved to one side to give him room. He took the spear back over his right shoulder, eyes still fixed on his target, and, stepping forward, made his cast. The spear flashed through the dark smoke and bit deeply into the man's lower leg. He let out a scream of pain and stopped, dropping to a crouch. He released his hold on his battle axe and clutched at the wound in his leg. The heavy spear shaft dangled over the drop, unbalancing him and trying to drag him after it. He tried to pull the spear loose, but couldn't manage it. He was stuck, unable to stand again, swaying fearfully over the gap while arrows hissed round his ears and slammed into the timber bridge beneath him. Holding his shield in front of him, he began to back clumsily away on the bridge, propelling himself with his free hand and his uninjured leg. His shield was now festooned with arrow shafts, as the archers maintained a constant barrage on him. Crossbow bolts whirred across the gap in return, and Cassandra heard a shout of pain from the stairs above her, as at least one found its mark. A lucky shot, she thought. Visibility was as poor for the attackers as the defenders. The air over the bridge was relatively clear, kept so by the draft coming up the gap in the stairwell. But everywhere else, the fumes and smoke made it almost impossible to find a target. The wounded man made it back to the safety of the lower edge of the gap and slumped back against the barrier's closed gate. He still kept his shield in front of him, protecting himself from the steady rain of arrows that continued to thud into the wood and hide shield. Blood poured from the spear wound in his leg. An arrow hit him on his right arm, and he flinched and cried out. But his voice was weak, and Cassandra realized that loss of blood was weakening him. Abruptly, the gate slammed open, and several pairs of hands grabbed at him, dragging him back into safety, accompanied by another hail of arrows flashing through the open gate. Cassandra studied the temporary bridge for several minutes, then flicked her gaze to the pike that Merlin had dropped. For the time being, both sides had stopped shooting, with no targets visible for either her archers or Diamond's crossbowmen. Earlier, Cassandra and her men had tried to push the bridge back across the gap, but the transverse beam, nailed in place a meter from its end, locked against the lip of the stairs and kept it from moving. But there was no similar beam at the upper end of the bridge, she realized. So there was nothing to stop them from pulling the timber structure up the stairs. She turned to look behind her, coughing, as an eddy of smoke whirled around her. The heavy-set, tall soldier who had thrown the spear was still close by. He'd do admirably for what she had in mind, she thought. She beckoned him forward and, as he knelt beside her, gestured to the fallen pike on the steps. The pike was a combination of different weapons, mounted on a stout ash shaft 2.5 meters long. It had an axe head on one side, a spear point at the top, and a vicious spike opposite the axe head. "See the pike," she said. The man nodded, and she pointed to the bridge. "When I give the word, drive the spike into the timbers and drag the bridge up toward us. Understand?" The man nodded, smiling, as he caught on to her idea. If he could haul the bridge up far enough, the bottom end of its two main beams would slip off the edge of the steps and the entire structure would plunge into the gap. He started to move forward, but she gripped his arm to stop him. "Wait till we get some cover for you," she said. Then, calling to the archers a few steps higher than she was, she gave her orders. Archers, rapid shooting. Keep their heads down.
Arrows started to fly across the gap once more in a steady stream. There were no visible targets, but the iron warheads screeched off the curved stone walls of the stairwell, striking sparks in the gloom as they did. Several arrows slammed into the wood of the barrier, but most skimmed over the top, ricocheting off the walls beyond, sometimes shattering the shafts and sending the razor-sharp broadheads spinning wildly through the air. They heard at least one hoarse yell of pain, which indicated that a broadhead had found a target. But the sudden arrow storm had the desired result. The attackers on the lower part of the stairway dropped to their bellies, hands over their heads, while the arrows hissed and spun and screeched among them. She released her grip on the soldier's muscular arm. "Now," she told him, and he lunged forward, gathering in the pike as he went. Then, from a kneeling position, he raised it over his head in a two-handed grip and brought it down with all his strength, driving the long spike into the timber planking of the bridge. Once it was set, he gathered his feet under him and began to heave the bridge forward, slowly, a few centimetres at a time. As the attackers realised what was happening, she saw hands scrabbling desperately under the barrier, trying to seize hold of the bridge and stop it. She darted out into the open, grabbing hold of the soldier's belt and adding her strength to his. Behind her, she felt someone else doing the same to her. She glanced over her shoulder and saw the young lad who had fetched the water. "Heave!" she shouted. "Keep it moving!" Under their combined strength, the long structure slid upward until its lower end slid off the step below them. Then it pitched up vertically and disappeared into the gap, taking the pike with it. The three of them released their grip and staggered backward on the stairs. For a moment, they listened to the clatter of the bridge falling into the darkness below, bouncing off walls, the noise gradually dying away. The archers on the stairs gave a ragged cheer as Cassandra and her two companions dragged themselves back into cover. Breathless, she sprawled on the stone steps with them, grinning triumphantly. She shook her head angrily. So much for Diamond's word. She had let him lull her into a feeling of false security, assuming he would hold off until the 24-hour period, and the implied truce that went with it, were over. He had caught her napping, and his attempt had come close to succeeding. She realized that she couldn't let her guard down again. 41. It was half an hour before sunup. As was his custom, Horace leaned on the palisade above the gate, staring moodily down at the enemy camp below. The campfires that had burned through the night had died down now to glowing ashes. They twinkled in the pre-dawn darkness, marking the lines of tents where the enemy slept. He knew there would be sentries awake, stationed around the perimeter of the camp, keeping an eye out for a possible attack, as he was doing. He felt a movement beside him, and, glancing around, saw that Gillen had joined him in his study of the enemy. "Morning," said Horace. Gillen grunted a reply, then said, "Thought I'd find you here." Horace smiled quietly. "Am I so predictable?" "Well, you're here most mornings. If that makes you predictable, then you are."
"Just keeping an eye on things down there," Horace said.
Gillen said nothing for a minute or so. He studied the lines of campfires, the silent, darkened tents.
"I don't think they'll try anything," he said at length. "We gave them a bloody nose last time they did."
"We gave them one at the river as well. At least you and your archers did," Horace said.
Gillen scratched his chin thoughtfully. Yes, it's two for none, isn't it? Do you think they'll change tactics next time? Frontal assaults don't seem to be working too well for them. I'm not sure what else they can do. Not if they want a quick ending to this. Gillen frowned. Maybe they plan to starve us out. We don't have enough provisions for a lengthy siege. We've got plenty of water, Horace said. Gillen shrugged. But not food. A couple of weeks would see us starving. Even worse, the horses won't last without proper fodder. So we're stuck here. We can't go anywhere. We can't break out. They still have us well and truly outnumbered. And if we try to attack them, they'll see us coming, and they'll be ready for us. We'll be out in the open. They'll be behind their shield wall, and we'll be fighting at a disadvantage. Horace nodded. Exactly. They may send a few skirmishers up the hill from time to time to keep us on our toes. But I think they'll be perfectly happy to sit back and watch us watching them. For a minute or so, the two friends were silent. Then Horace asked, Do you think you could sneak out through their lines? Gillen nodded emphatically. Of course I could. But then what? I can't sneak Blaze out with me. Travelling on foot, it'd take me a week or so to reach Castle Araluin. And then what? Diamon only has 20 or 30 men there. That's hardly enough to help us break out. And I couldn't bring them all back. We can't leave the castle undefended. That's true, Horace replied gloomily. So I guess all we can do is wait and see what they have in mind. Unless, he said with a rueful grin, you can come up with a brilliant strategy. I hear rangers are good at that. Gillen rolled his eyes. I've heard that too, he said. I'll let you know if anything occurs to me. I wish you would, said Horace. Maddie reached the clear ground below the castle around mid-morning. Bumper was already there, back in his hidden glade, and he greeted her enthusiastically.
I was worried about you.
I was fine, she told him. I was just a little lost in the forest.
Fine ranger you are.
That's what I told myself. She unsaddled him and rubbed him down, then filled his water bucket, and poured more grain into his feed bag. He munched gratefully, grinding the food noisily with his big teeth, the way horses do. Once she was assured that his needs were taken care of, she started toward the edge of the trees to survey the castle. Everything seemed normal. The drawbridge was down. There were two sentries keeping guard at the outside end, and she could see more moving on the battlements. There was no sign or sound of any fighting, which she might have expected if Diamond was attempting to take the castle. Perhaps he's already done it, she thought dismally. After all, if his plan had worked, he and his men would have simply walked in across the drawbridge. Any fighting would have been over in a matter of minutes, with the castle's defenders and her mother taken by surprise. Perhaps, she thought, her mother was already dead, and she felt tears pricking her eyelids at the thought. She leaned against the trunk of a tree while she considered what she was seeing. Everything seemed normal, but something was different. She sensed that there was one slight detail that had changed since she had last looked at the castle, but for the life of her, she couldn't work out what it was. She scanned the castle, eyes slitted in concentration as she studied the walls, the towers, the battlements, trying to realize what it was that had pricked her attention. Not the keep, not the battlements along the outer wall, not the massive gatehouse. Was it one of the towers?
She studied the North Tower, then the South. Completely normal, with a flag fluttering over it. A flag? There had been no flag on the South Tower last time she looked. She strained her eyes and could see a trace of red on white, a red stooping hawk. Her mother's banner! Looking more closely, she realized that the banner was flying upside down, the universal distress signal. And in that moment, she knew what had happened. Diamond's coup had been successful, at least partly so. But her mother had obviously had time to retreat to the South Tower, the point of last defense. With the realization that her mother was safe, at least temporarily, Maddie's spirits lifted. She looked up the slope to the small clump of bushes that concealed the entrance to the tunnel. They were undisturbed. She started forward, ready to move out of the trees, then hesitated. It was full daylight, and the battlements were manned with sentries, enemy sentries. Skilled as she was at moving without being seen, it wasn't worth the risk. The parkland was kept open and well mowed for precisely that reason, to prevent attackers from approaching unseen. If her mother was safely ensconced in the South Tower, another few hours wouldn't make any difference. Maddie would wait until dusk, then make her move. In the meantime, she thought, she might as well get some rest. She'd had a long, sleepless night, and an exhausting day. The hours dragged by. Tired as she was, sleep came fitfully. She dozed, waking frequently, with her mind racing as she considered the situation. She was reminded once more of Will's dictum. Most of our time is spent waiting. A ranger's best asset is patience. At last, the sun sank below the horizon, and shadows crept over the parkland. This was probably the best time for her to move, while the light was fluky and uncertain. She went back into the trees to say farewell to Bumper, and then, wrapped in her cloak, stole out onto the short grass of the park, moving in a crouch, matching her rhythm to that of the wind and cloud shadows flitting across the grass. She held the cloak tightly to keep it from flapping in the rising breeze. Movement like that could attract the eye of one of the sentries. She ghosted up the slope as the evening grew darker. When she finally slipped into the shelter of the bushes, concealing the tunnel entrance, there had been no outcry from the battlements. No sound of alarm. She found her lantern still at the tunnel entrance where she had left it. She shook it experimentally and heard the splash of oil inside its reservoir. There was still plenty there, she thought. Enough for two passages through the tunnel. Mindful of the watching eyes on the battlements, she moved several meters into the tunnel before she struck her flint and lit the lantern wick. The yellow light flared out, wavering over the rough clay walls. She checked that she had her sling and her sacks, then set off. She was familiar with the tunnel now, and she made good time, passing under the moat, then feeling the tunnel climbing upward. Stumbling from time to time on the uneven footing, she made it into the hidden room in the bottom cellar and moved toward the secret door, then stopped. As her hand stretched out to trip the lock, she heard a murmur of voices from the other side. She put her ear to the stone and listened. She still couldn't make out what was being said. The voices started again, then one of them, raised higher than the others, came through more clearly.
How you like a night in the cells? You might... more friendly tomorrow. Good night.
A door clanged shut. One of the cell doors, she thought. Then she heard the clack of boot heels on stone. Someone was crossing the cellar and mounting the steps. She waited, her ear pressed against the stone. Her pulse was